From WXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on a military aircraft where a U.S. service member was waiting to jump. That service member was watching the light, a red light, that was about to change. He knows that when the light turns green, it's time to go. As Jason Skinner notes, that service member's training makes that process automatic. But service member training does not often include help in transitioning back to civilian life. Training covers so much and makes so much automatic. But there are gaps here, and Skinner is concerned about this. He's director of the Livingston County Veteran Services and a veteran of the U.S. Army himself. He helped launch Operation Greenlight, a collaboration meant to educate the public about the need to support veterans returning to civilian life. You might notice green lights and illuminated buildings. Operation Greenlight has the support of the County Executive Association, New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio, and Governor Kathy Hochul, who had Niagara Falls illuminated in green. But what happens beyond the lighting of green here? On this Veterans Day, our attention is on the need of veterans who are more vulnerable to depression and suicide, on top of the daily challenge of reintegration to civilian life. Our guest this hour include the director of Livingston County Veteran Services, and as I mentioned, a U.S. Army veteran himself, Jason Skinner, is with us. Jason, thank you for making the time.
Thank you for having me, Evan. I appreciate every time I've been on your show. You're such a gracious host, and I do appreciate the opportunity to speak on Veterans Day about this important issue.
It is important, and we're glad you're here. And Brigadier General, retired General Mike Eastman is with us, who is the executive director of the ETS Sponsorship Program. Brigadier General Eastman, tell us a little bit about what the ETS sponsorship program is, and I should say thank you as well for being with us.
Well, I really appreciate the opportunity to speak today. Thanks for having me on. ETS sponsorship is we're a nonprofit, and we're partnering with Jason and a number of organizations across New York State. And our mission is really dedicated to helping service members of all branches transition back into civilian life.
I am the son of a veteran, and I am grateful for both of your service, gentlemen, and the many people that you have served with. Veterans are not only in our thoughts today, but the focus this hour is on the best ways to help. And so briefly, Jason, maybe right off the top here, give me a sense for how Operation Greenlight came about and what you'd like to see here.
Well, it was very interesting how this kind of organically happened. I have reached out to our New York State Association of Counties in ways that we could collaborate together. And collaboration really does help us become more effective and gives us a better capacity. And the two organizations, the New York State Association of County Veteran Service Officers, I'm the president of that. So having these conversations, they asked, well, what can we do? And we talked about Operation Greenlight as a way to shine a light on military service and that transition, the anxiety that somebody may feel, just like, jumping out of that plane. In the military, you're trained to trust in your equipment, have faith in your leadership, and you'll have a safe and successful landing. Standing in front of that door the first time is very difficult for somebody in training. But now you think about jumping out of that plane into the civilian world. Where's your parachute? Where's your training? We don't have any recruiting stations. We have lots of recruiting stations. So we think about, what are things that we can do in local government as a government official? We think about how great our veterans are in our community when, their advocacy and continued service and veterans groups like the American Legion, VFW, DAVs, Vietnam Veterans of America, all of these groups and organizations do so much in our community and often don't go recognized. But we've lost 44% of our veteran population over the last 20 years here in New York State, and their capacity kind of dwindles. We can help by innovating this space, bringing more veterans to New York State. Another thing our government can do is work to remove certain restrictions. The first thing you're losing when you get out of the military is your job. You have a family, you want to provide. So the hardest thing to get over is, we want great employees. There's been millions of dollars spent training these people in very specialist areas. like emergency management and things of that nature. So we're hoping that we can help remove some of the residency requirements for civil service tests. A lot of people don't realize in order to work for your county, you have to be a resident of your county. Or, you know, for state civil service tests, you must be a resident of that state. So if you're serving in, say, Colorado, and you were ordered there, and that's, you know, what we do in the military. We follow our orders. We are stationed where we're told to be. And if you were even a native of New York State, but were stationed in Colorado, you would have to live here first and then take the test. You'd have a gap of employment and potential, you know, financial hardship. So those are a couple simple things that we can do beyond the shining of a green light.
Mike, you want to add your thoughts to that on maybe some ideas, if you want to build on what Jason is adding there about what we can all be thinking about?
Yeah, sure. I think it's important to just sort of step back a little bit and really take a look at what are the challenges service members encounter when they leave, because that's where we start the conversation. There's a lot that we could all do, but it starts with understanding the veteran themselves. Because what happens when you leave military service? You know, first, you lose a sort of sense of identity. You're part of a team, a larger team. You're working in pursuit of a mission that is generally greater than any one of us. And then you're a civilian. And for a lot of our new veterans in particular, that can leave you feeling a little bit lost. You're kind of adrift. You don't exactly know how you fit in. And then there's sort of, as Jason mentioned, there's a loss of structure that you have become accustomed to, and a loss of sort of a chain of command. The folks above you look out for you. You look out for the folks beneath you. But that doesn't necessarily always translate in an immediate sense when you become a civilian. And then there are some practical sort of obstacles when you go through this process. It's difficult at times for service members to really translate what they have done or the skills they've learned into terms that in the civilian world other people can relate to. You know, I'm an artilleryman. I've been shooting cannons for 30 years. I have a series of probably unquantifiable skills that come along with that in terms of leadership and organization. But for many new veterans, putting those into a resume and then helping an employer understand them can be a challenge. And then I said, frankly, finally, there's sort of also this prevailing view out there that I think we have to educate folks about that, you know, veterans as a population oftentimes struggle against a view in the public that having been a veteran during a period of war means that you are inherently damaged, either physically or emotionally, or you suffer with, you know, PTSD or what have you. And while that certainly impacts a fraction of the veteran population, it does not impact or get in the way of the vast majority of them. But all veterans, I think, at some level, have to struggle through and let their future employers, their future communities understand that they're great Americans, they're exceptionally capable, and they're ready to contribute to their community.
And, Mike, I think you've drawn an important distinction that we should probably be keeping in mind here, and that distinction is between junior officers or just younger personnel versus older personnel. You've written that your own transition has some similarities, but it's also different. The average enrollee in your program is 27 years old, married, served 4 to 8 years, joined the military right out of high school. And I think it's important if we could kind of talk a little bit about how you see the difference between sort of reintegration to civilian life based on age, life experience, and additional stressors.
Certainly. So you know, I speak about this topic quite frequently, and oftentimes I get the question, you know, describe my own transition. And I'm happy to do that. But in all honesty, transitioning as a general officer, it's got parallels, but it's not the same. It's not the same set of challenges. I mean, I have a retirement. The Army was good enough to send me to get multiple graduate degrees. I have 30 years of experience. So while I might and have sort of had to work my way through things like a change in responsibility, I've gone from leading 12, 15,000 people to basically leading myself and a small organization, those things are challenging. But it's a different category altogether when you are a young veteran that has served 1 to 2 terms. You've come straight out of high school. So you never really had to make that leap into full-time civilian employment. Many things the military has provided for you. It's provided your medical care. It's kind of told you what you're going to do on any given day. It's got a very structured way for you to excel, and you know what you need to do to get promoted. Those things, when you take them away from a younger person, and then you add to that, most of them are fairly newly married. Many of them have young children. They're facing a transition in their life where they are facing unemployment and needing to move and needing to get health care and life insurance and the range of things that, you know, many of us sort of take for granted, right? We all do these things. But for this particular population, while their peers were navigating those you know, necessary life challenges, they found themselves in Iraq or Afghanistan in a totally different environment, worried about a totally different set of things. So it's just magnified that the scale of that change.
I also want to ask you, frankly, I want to ask both of you about what you are seeing, especially since August. And retired Brigadier General Eastman, I think, has some special insight into a population of veterans who are returning to communities after serving in Afghanistan. Now, I have made clear to Mike before the program, and we're going to honor this, this is not a conversation about the politics of withdrawal. This is not a debate about right or wrong or what the previous president said or what this president said. This is a conversation about the impact on veterans, generally speaking. Everyone's different, but the impact on people who are returning to communities all across this country, some having just served recently, some having served for years there. And Mike, as a retired general yourself, you were essentially the last commander of Kandahar. Do you have special concern about how veterans are doing in the last few months, especially those returning from Afghanistan?
Well, I do, and I think similar concerns apply to it. I mean, I had the opportunity to serve in both Iraq and Afghanistan multiple times, and as you described, I was the last commander of Kandahar and effectively the southern half of the country of Afghanistan. I would say first that the polling shows us that 60% roughly of today's veterans question whether the wars and their participation in them were worth it. And I think that sort of mental struggle, the emotional struggle that they have is real. It's difficult. I don't know that it's going to lead to negative outcomes necessarily, but it just presents another obstacle. They are rightfully proud of what they have done, and they should be. They've done some great things. They've built schools, they've trained militaries, they've trained police forces. They've accomplished really great things. But at the same time, many of those things, the analogy I would use is they've built some really exceptional and elaborate sandcastles on the beach. And the tide has come in, and most of those constructs are being swept away. And it's difficult then to have the conversation around the dinner table, frankly. You know, Dad, why were you gone for so long? It looks like we didn't really achieve much. So, you know, I'll just say it's a further obstacle that a veteran has to, one, in their own mind, understand that their service is valuable. They did a great job. They did what they were asked. And then translate that in conversations with civilians and others that weren't there, that the larger conversation as a nation of what we did or didn't achieve is in no way a reflection on their individual contributions.
We've talked a great deal on this program about SIVs, and we've been having those conversations for years. There's a dynamic and powerful organization in Western New York that serves, among many, I'm sure, across the country. And Mike, I'm curious to know if there's maybe an even additional stressor. If you have served in a country like Afghanistan, and you've worked with Afghans who risked their lives and were given some sort of promise, I don't know if promise, some sort of hope that their work with the U.S. military would allow them and their families some safety, some passage perhaps to the United States, some protection from the Taliban and other forces. Is there an additional stressor on veterans, many of whom were not able to see, frankly, their friends and colleagues who were Afghans brought to safety?
Well, I will only comfortably speak about my own experience. I continue to get, given my last position and my years in those countries, emails and calls from partners that we work with that were left behind, as well as from soldiers that worked with and for me that are concerned for them. It is absolutely it's a stressor. It's difficult to reconcile. And frankly, you feel a bit helpless because with every fiber of my being, I would love to get all of those whose lives are at risk right now and the lives of their families are in danger because of their association with us to safety. But it simply can't be done. The assets at present don't exist to get them all out in the numbers that it would require. And so it does take some conversations and some really active listening to appreciate that this doesn't help. We all have them in our thoughts and our prayers, but there's a limit to what can be done, regardless of what we might like to do.
Mm. And when you said, just to kind of wrap one more point, and then I want to turn to Jason's experience on this. Mike, I just to clarify here, 60%, tell me what that 60% number represents regarding whether deployment was worth it.
Yeah, so it's a survey done by Pew, and it's something that I've looked at in our research as we try and find ways to help veterans integrate back into civilian life. And the question was simply, was your participation in the war in Afghanistan or Iraq worth it? And the numbers of veterans that are questioning that based on, as you've identified, either the people that we are unable, at least at the present time, to help get out, or an apparent lack of progress. 60% now are questioning whether their service was worth the sacrifice they made in terms of either, in the worst case, lost comrades, but in the more common case, just simply time away from home and missed birthdays and missed holidays. They're looking for a sense of closure that is at the moment a little bit elusive.
So what do you tell them though, Mike? I mean, do you think your service in Afghanistan, in Kandahar, was worth it?
I always tell, in my case, the soldiers that I've been working with, that it was, right? We signed up to do a mission and we did it to the very best of our ability. You cannot always change what goes on above you, but you absolutely can positively impact what happens around you and below you. And I tell them in all genuine sincerity that I know their actions have made a difference in the lives of the Afghans and the Iraqis with which they associated. And there's some comfort to be taken in that.
Jason, what are you seeing, particularly on the issue of returning veterans from Afghanistan?
Well, it's interesting, serving veterans, putting in for disability claims, getting connected with the earned benefits that they have in my role, and also having my own personal experience with serving in Iraq and watching the news after I reached, ETS'd. It is difficult. I will tell you, though, that even after Afghanistan's withdrawal, there were a lot of Vietnam veterans seeking help. A lot of people don't realize that the last two Marines that were killed in action were during the rollout or the withdrawal, and it took a year for those two Marines to be returned to the United States with the help of Senator Ted Kennedy. And so a lot of those people were having and reaching out with their needs. And, it is interesting. A lot of people want to believe that there's still quite a bit of mental health needs for veterans, but the number one and number two disability that veterans are diagnosed with are hearing loss and tinnitus. Occupations are occupations, and injuries and disabilities are based on, probability of what you're exposed to. So even if you're a motor vehicle operator, tank driver, helicopter pilot, hearing loss is number one. So maybe speak a little louder rather than, assume that we're having a hard time processing it. I know I did, originally after I left Iraq in the service and special emphasis on our interpreters, they served with us. If it weren't for us or them, they would not be able to help us communicate with the villagers that we would visit from one civil affairs missions to the other. And so, yeah, they were you know, part of our team in a way. And I wish we could have supported them more. But end of the day, they're not U.S. personnel, and they're not my service comrade. But however, I would have loved to see every one of them granted some sort of special immigrant visa. And be able to come here and live the life we do as a, you know, token of our appreciation. But my personal opinion, you know, I'm sure there are many other opinions out there, and that's what makes America great, is we all have that right, regardless of service or not. And, you know, I get to serve veterans every day. It's an honor. But I think, you know, when we talk about connections, the name of your show, and the purpose of the ETS sponsorship program that we're talking about today is actually making those connections between a sponsor that's trained here at home to help that soldier, airman, Marine, Coast Guard individual, you know, or Navy personnel to transition. So they're going to be able to sign up for this program that General Eastman is here talking about, put their information into a computer screen, and communicate with somebody to where they've identified that they're going to come home to. And it's going to help ease that anxiety and that transition. And they're going to have somebody, you know, here, hopefully in New York State and in my region, will be bringing people in, answering those questions, relieving some of that anxiety of that transition, and, you know, quite literally making those connections with sponsors within our community.
And in a moment, we'll make sure that our listeners know exactly the resources they could find or turn to if they know someone who needs them. But let me just ask you, Jason, what I asked General Eastman, which is just when you encounter someone who is in that 60% saying, I my deployment wasn't worth it, or I'm questioning it. It hurts to question it. It hurts to wonder what it was all for. What do you tell them?
You know, I do tell them, one is the vet center is up in Rochester on Winton Road. They're the best place to talk to somebody about that. You know, they're not connected electronically to the VA. They're run by the VA, and they have amazing mental health providers. You know, and every war veteran, anyone who has been, you know, deployed is eligible. And I believe it's 1-800-WAR-VETS that gets you connected straight to them. So counseling is something that I talk about with pretty much everyone. I say, you know what, while I can tell you I agree, or, you know, I can sit here and tell you all day long that you have every right to feel the way you do, and empower that individual to feel that way, and ensure they're going to be okay, you know, because that's the kind of the number one thing you want to do, is ensure that before you send somebody off that you encounter, that they're not struggling to the point of suicidal ideation. But, you know, make sure that you're also kind of validating their reasoning. You know, everybody has a right to feel the way they feel, and it may feel different for one guy or another female or whoever that served overseas. It's not mine to judge or tell them how they should feel, but they need to explore that, and they need a professional to help them navigate that. And that's just not my role. I really do believe in our trained mental health providers that are there as a benefit to their service. You know, the VA is providing that service, and it is a benefit that if we don't use it, they may move to a higher populated area because we've lost 44% of our veterans. That's something I really fear, is without utilization of these benefits, you know, other states are losing about 13% over the last 20 years. So they may realign our resources, and we really need them here.
Talking to Jason Skinner, a U.S. Army veteran and the director of the Livingston County Veterans Services. General Mike Eastman is with us, Brigadier General, who is now retired and the executive director of the ETS sponsorship program. And after we take our only break of the hour, we will talk about access to services. And listeners, if you know veterans in your own life and you are concerned, or you've got questions, you've got maybe insight to share, we're talking about the return to civilian life this hour. And as we honor Veterans Day this year, we're thinking about thousands of Americans who are in that position, now or have been recently. Many have struggled. There's mental health concerns and more. And if you want to share concerns, comments, insight, etc., it's 844-295-TALK. You can call us toll-free, 844-295-8255. 263-WXXI if you're calling from Rochester, 263-9994. You can email the program connections@WXXI.org. We also want to tell you that it would be wonderful, I think, for all of us to stay in touch with the American Veterans Series. It's a 4-part broadcast on PBS, a 10-part digital series, and a 9-part podcast series. It's called the American Veterans Series, all produced by veterans, with veterans interviewing and being interviewed. It's available right now, WXXI.org/veterans. Coming up in our second hour, two Rochesterians were among the 240 U.S. service members who died in a bombing in Beirut in 1983. The U.S. Marine barracks was bombed by a terrorist bomber. Now, this is a story that many of us don't know in full. And you're going to meet one of the survivors telling that important story next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Wayne writes to say, Evan, I'm an Army veteran, retired after 25 years, deployed 4 times. My comment for the program is, in my experience, most soldiers transitioning are extremely unprepared mentally. They join out of a patriotic ideal of serving their country, which is a very admirable trait. But many don't have a realistic view of the full scope of their lives during and after military service. Even those who plan to make the military a career need to be prepared for a next career after the military, because it isn't realistic to live off of a military retirement. This should be communicated more often. In my civilian career, this happens during annual performance reviews. I think it would be helpful for service members to also have that discussion during their annual evaluations. General Eastman, what do you think of Wayne's comment?
I think that's an exceptional suggestion. The system as it exists right now, we, as Jason mentioned at the top of your show, we're really good and a lot of resources are dedicated to bringing civilians in and turning them into service members. And there's an entire infrastructure dedicated to that for good reason, right? We may put them in harm's way. We want them to be trained and capable to the highest level that we can. On the other end, though, as they prepare to depart the military and transition back into civilian life, we don't dedicate sufficient time or resources to that process. And so I think engaging more frequently, engaging earlier, and giving our service members the time and the information to make good decisions and fully appreciate the transition they're going to make could only be beneficial.
Jason Skinner, what do you think?
You know, I love his comments because I've seen so many, retirees and veterans come into our office for benefits and talk about, VA healthcare and things of that nature. And one gentleman said, I was in the Air Force and I was an industrial hygienist and I'm looking for a job. And, rural communities probably only have one job position in their area that potentially would fit that career path. And so, you want to come home, you want to go to that familiar surroundings of where you came from when you, joined the military. But really, that one person's already got that position. So you're going to have to wait until they retire. So, it would be helpful. And that's why the ETS sponsorship program exists is, the retiree that made the comment there, I believe it was Wayne, perfect idea, perfect person we need to be a sponsor, to help that next person, to help, them transition that person. And, in my belief, a lot of these people that are coming out of the military may be retirees. We've been at war for 20 years. It takes 20 years to retire. And a lot of people are serving longer and being deployed more often. So, if there are retirees, it's not a mentorship program, it's a sponsorship program, but this person would be an ideal person to help the next, person move into their community and integrate a little easier.
So once again, as we talk about Operation Greenlight, as listeners may see, green lights around New York State and various places. Jason, remind people who aren't with us off the top of the program what that is all about And for those who know a veteran in their life that they are thinking about, maybe concerned about, where do you want them to start if they if they've got those concerns?
Well, I think first and foremost, Operation Green Light is shining a light on military service. The difficulty in transition as well. We're focused on right now the individuals transitioning out of service, so that we can help ease that transition. Many people find within that first year, as they call the deadly gap, many pitfalls, financial, mental, or even health-wise, and they're not getting connected immediately with their earned benefits. And we need to do a better job of connecting them. So if you know, best way is to get on the VA's website, va.gov. And you can also connect with your local veteran service agency or the state division of veteran services. Every county has a veteran service office in New York State, all 62 counties. They all have different resources. And we have our New York State reps as well that work out there virtually. And so if you want to connect with them, you can go to State Division of Veteran Services website to get their information. But for the most part, if you're concerned, that's another case. If you know somebody, it's one thing to say, well, maybe you should check out your VA healthcare. If you're concerned, why are you concerned? Start asking questions. What is that concern? What does that mean? Is this a call to the crisis line? Is this, what level of concern is? So, don't be afraid to talk. You're just having a conversation. And that's what I see a lot in my world with veterans. A lot of people are like, well, I'm concerned about my friend, but I'm not going to do anything. And, what you really need to do is just ask, how are you doing? What's going on with you? You seem a little off. Let's talk. That's all it takes.
Generally, it's been the same kind of question. What do you want people to know about how to get the help people need?
Well, I think Jason certainly covered the range of options that are there, and having that honest and sincere conversation is a good start. I do think it's important to frame that for the majority of veterans, that isn't necessarily the struggle that they confront. I mean, we have a subset for sure that would benefit from, on the extreme, immediate access to counseling and someone to talk through whatever they're struggling with in their life. But for the vast majority, what we're really talking about here is helping them through a life transition. And that, in many ways, is no different than any life transition that any of us go through, whether it's losing a job or losing a spouse or what have you. And so in that sense, our program is really designed to connect them with sponsors from the community that they intend to live in and work through some of the practical stressors that cause our veterans to be less successful than they might otherwise be. If I'm serving in Germany and I'd like to live in New York, at the moment, it's very difficult for me to ask questions like, how is the job market in this community? Do my spouse's credentials transfer? How are the schools for my kids? And it's questions like that, frankly, that for the majority of new veterans compound and make this process harder than it needs to be. So establishing a connection, a human connection, between a service member on active duty and a community that they hope to live in, we really find is what sets conditions for a successful transition.
General Eastman, just reading a little bit more about your work, you authored the joint warfighting concept for the U.S. Secretary of Defense, designed to help define how armed forces will be equipped and employed, securing the nation in future years. And I'm curious to know if you see the role of future service members changing dramatically from maybe what your generation versus the current, 20-somethings and future generations are experiencing. I mean, obviously the world changes, technology changes. Sometimes politics does have an impact. There is, at least for now, some sort of closer alignment than there's been in a long time between leaders in major political parties, this president and the previous president. Their rhetoric has been pretty similar about not engaging as often around the world. So I'm curious to know if you think there will be a marked difference in how U.S. forces are deployed in future years?
I think if you look at the scope of history, every conflict we have, there are continuities in warfare, and then there are changes. And certainly, as we move into the next era of whatever warfare becomes, right, it's impossible to predict. I think there are some things you can say with some amount of certainty. The technology that's applied, whether that's artificial intelligence or long-range weapons or hypersonics, is going to change the way the war itself is fought. There's no question. Just like tanks replaced horses and machine guns made muskets a bit irrelevant. But there's also a human factor. And the human factor is it comes down to the man or woman on the ground or on the ship or in an airplane to be capable and successfully execute their job, to lead people through the most terrible conditions you can imagine and to come out the other side of that successful. And so I think to bring it to this conversation, what matters most is our veterans today are the recruiters for the service members tomorrow. And whatever the character of that conflict looks like, and however the war is fought, it's going to rely on having sufficient numbers of really good young Americans that raise their right hand and join military service. And that's why this whole thing becomes a cycle. We respect our veterans for what they've done. We help them reintegrate into the community, and then they can serve as examples for the next generation that we can and will prepare to fight that war when it comes, however it comes.
How do both of you think, and I'll start with General Eastman, how do you think the current reputation of military service is compared to when you were first entering service, Mike?
Well, I think it's different. I mean, there are certainly parallels to previous conflicts. When I think about this, a lot of it has to do with sort of the larger fabric of the conflict itself. Veterans that were coming out of the Great Wars, for instance, you know, they're the greatest generation today. And their service in many ways is no different from a veteran of today. But the way we think about the conflict colors our interpretation of that service. So when you deployed overseas and defeated the Nazis and really reestablished the free world, that colors how people think about your service, as opposed to today, where we're not quite sure what we've achieved. We're not quite sure if it was, you know, worth the cost or not. And that gets reflected on the veteran as well. So I don't know that service itself, it's a very human thing. You're leading a group of people through difficult conditions, and there's a lot of teamwork and camaraderie and sense of service before self. That's very much consistent over time. But how we think about that service is colored by the conflicts that we fight in.
How do you see it, Jason?
You know, I wholeheartedly agree. And I think General Washington was the first one to come up with a concept of how you treat your veterans as, you know, directly proportional to, you know, future engagements and people, you know, willing to volunteer. I will say, you know, for me personally, you know, I was lucky, you know, when I was still in, I met some people up around, you know, Boonville, New York, and, you know, Chief Warrant Officer Mark Shoemaker, he kind of took me under his wing, almost as a mentor, a Vietnam veteran who kind of showed me what advocacy was all about and doing what we do to help other veterans. He, you know, he's passed now. He, you know, had diabetes and all the many different things that Vietnam veterans had. He was, you know, shot down twice, had several different, you know, Purple Hearts and things of that nature. But they weren't as honored as I was. So while I was still in, I asked my command sergeant major and my first sergeant to honor four of them that all served in the air cavalry in Vietnam. And our unit, 3rd Squadron, 17th Cavalry up at Fort Drum, brought them up, had a big gala, put, you know, gold spurs on their feet. People were fighting, you know, soldiers were fighting to have this honor to put the spur on their feet, because the combat spur is something we earn by being deployed. And this was something that they had never received, this sort of recognition. And it was very well understood from the command on down. During this gala we had for them, that they were the ones that, you know, paved our way. They're the ones that flew helicopters first in war, And they're the ones that tested things until it broke. And those things, the things they wrote down, the policies and procedures that they did, those tactics and things saved our lives and paved our way. And so that's kind of, you know, what I think of, you know, when I have my mentor there who really taught me what it is to pay it forward and honor those who advocated. You know, I think today we have an entirely different perspective on what it means to serve. We know the difference between our sentiment about the war because of those who served in Vietnam and how they were treated. And I really have to say that I really appreciate that Vietnam veteran that stood up and made sure that my generation and future generations wouldn't be disrespected, and that all, you know, future generations would be honored the way that I am. And I am eternally grateful for that.
Let me, that question came up from based on an email from a listener. So let me read that now. Sarah says, my son is a veteran. My Sean is a veteran. Maybe her son is Sean, and says, thought that the Army would be his life. Getting a job is a real thing, and I don't always think his status as a veteran has helped him get a job. That's an interesting comment from Sarah. General Eastman, what do you think about that?
Well, I think it's both fair and not terribly uncommon. Part of this is we don't do a great job, as we've already mentioned, necessarily helping our new veterans translate what they've experienced, what they've earned, what they've learned into a way that allows them to really compete favorably with their civilian counterparts. And to be fair, if you've served 8 years in the military, your peers that you went to high school with have 8 years of practical experience, perhaps, in the field that you want to go into. So how do we help our veterans articulate those other things that they bring to sort of compensate for the lack of practical experience on the job in terms of leadership and teamwork and responsibility? Most young veterans today, if you're a 25-year-old, I don't know, lieutenant, it's quite likely that you were placed in charge of an entire town as effectively a mayor for several thousand people. And you were managing everything from sanitation to security, and you were fighting a war at the same time. But that is difficult. We as veterans understand inherently what that means. But translating that to a potential employer when you're seeking a job, it often reads as is either incomprehensible military speak or something so grandiose that it doesn't really resonate. We work with our veterans to help them on how do you translate in a way that resonates what you bring that offsets the practical experience on the job that you have given up by serving in uniform.
Jason, what would you say to Sarah?
Well, I definitely agree. You know, this is a common challenge, you know, for people that do transition. You know, it's similar to college. You know, you learn something in 4 years or more. You are trained to do something. And just like college, you expect when you get out that you have the certificate that's somehow going to get you a job. And it's difficult. Every transition is difficult. Other people are competing for those same jobs. You know, I think what, you know, the veteran generally needs to kind of focus on is what makes them stand out more so is the discipline, the integrity, all of those things that are ingrained in you from all of your training that's not necessarily your specialty. Those are the qualities employers want. You know, some of them are actually, you know, willing to help you learn on the job and work with you, but they really want somebody that's going to show up, somebody that, you know, is really, really, really going to put more into it. And I that's just military and veterans. They tend to put their entire life into their career. That's, you know, because that's what they know. Their entire life, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning, running, you know, 4 miles, taking your shower, going to eat, you know, you live in a structured life that, you know, even your barracks is where you work. And you are constantly working 24/7. So, you know, it's not difficult for them when they transition to a job to think, wow, I'm only working 8 hours. I have to come and go. And so, yeah, they'll be early, because if you're not 15 minutes early to your job, you're late. That's just the military and what it ingrains in you. So there are a lot of things that, you know, when we sell ourselves in an interview, that we have to be proud. And I think sometimes it's hard for active duty or anyone who served in the military to really brag about themselves because they are competing against others. And maybe they just have a hard time selling themselves.
Jason, before we lose the hour here, there's one other part of this conversation that I think is probably vital, because as we know, more American veterans are going to be leaving their service posts over the next 12 months. There's a lot that's been happening in the last 12 months. So it's probably just a higher number of veterans returning to civilian life than we typically see at any one point. And we're in the midst of that right now. And one of the things that veterans may hear with some frequency, and I don't want to caricaturize, but one of the things that they may hear if they're dealing with mental health issues, depression, struggling to find work, struggling to sort of find themselves, is the idea of just manning up. How often do people still hear that, and what do you make of that, Jason?
I don't know if they hear that very often, to be honest with you. You know, in my role, sitting here in my office, hoping, you know, to get more and more veterans in, and you know, we do outreach and we do a lot of different things. They're already past that whole manning up piece. They're coming in and they're reaching out for assistance. So, you know, I haven't been, you know, bearing witness to any of that. You know, I don't know. It's kind of one of those things, though. I think the military in active duty right now is getting better and better and better with mental health awareness, and that may be translating to today's veteran that's more willing to reach out.
General Eastman, how do you see that?
I agree. These are difficult conversations to have with folks, and certainly there was a period of time where service members in general were concerned that, you know, if I went and said I'm having these problems or I need help, it would reflect negatively. I'd lose my clearance, or I wouldn't maybe compete as well as I could for promotion. And I think we've really turned the corner on that. Manning up is admitting when you're in a place where you need help, not hiding it or not pretending you don't have a problem, but simply accepting, hey, this is more than I can handle right now, and I need to talk to someone that can help me work my way through it. That is true strength, and I think we're really making some strides there. And I would encourage anyone that feels overwhelmed or lost or is struggling with these sort of things to really seek out the help that they might need, because at the end of the day, they'll come out of that process as strong or stronger than before.
You really feel like the culture is changing in that regard, though, Mike?
Well, I tell you, there's several examples of really senior officers that have come out publicly and said, I struggled with this for years and I got help and here's why I did. It's not perfect, for sure. There are going to be pockets anywhere of individuals that think admitting you're struggling with something mentally or emotionally is a sign of weakness. I just simply say, and I think I speak for the majority of my peers, that's not our view. Our view is it takes a great amount of strength to say when you can't handle something on your own. It doesn't make you a lesser person. Sometimes it's what you need to do so that you can come back to contributing to your full potential.
All right. Last couple of minutes, as we've had, I think, a really important hour talking about Operation Greenlight. I want to give both of our guests the floor to make some final remarks as we honor the work of veterans and the service of veterans on this Veterans Day, but also think about the importance that every community has in making sure all members of their communities can be a part of civilian life, let alone veterans who may struggle with that. Jason, what do you want to leave with listeners today?
Well, I think, you know, if they have a green light or can get one, put one out tonight, you know, light up your house, show them, because I, strangely enough, was just driving through the neighborhood last night, and because it's getting darker earlier, I'm starting to see it. It makes me somewhat emotional knowing that, you know, other people do care. You know, it's one thing that we're not just hearing on TV or on the radio. You know, there's someone in that house that cares. It does resonate. It is a simple thing that you can do to say, welcome home, thank you, Light anything up you can in green. This is how you can show your support without having to try to identify somebody, because this is the hardest part, right? People that leave the military are more camouflaged than ever, right? They're not wearing their uniform, so you don't know who's who, and not everybody wears a hat. You know, it says veteran across it. So, you know, we want to thank them for their service. You want to show your support. Light something up in green. You know, our governor is lighting up all the state landmarks in support of this, because we started this here locally and it grew like crazy. You know, New York City landmarks as well. So, you know, at the very least, do that. Please.
And about 30 seconds, General, go ahead.
Well, I'd just like to thank you and all your listeners today for taking the time to talk about our veterans. They're great Americans. You know, they all raise their right hand because they love this country. And I don't think any of them expect special treatment when they get back. I think they'd like to be acknowledged for what they've done, but more importantly, they'd like to be embraced. So thank you.
Retired Brigadier General Mike Eastman is the Executive Director of the ETS Sponsorship Program. General Eastman, thank you for your service and the time today.
Thanks for having me.
Jason Skinner, a U.S. Army veteran, director of Livingston County Veteran Services. Jason, same. Thank you for your service and thanks for the time and the work today.
Thank you, Evan. Appreciate it.
More connections coming up in a moment.